Hey everyone, it's time once again for the Image Doctors. This is episode number 52 for October 25th, 2007. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And thanks for joining us again as we delve into the world of Nikonians. We've got a fun episode today.
Yeah, kind of a mixed bag of things.
And so, keeping in the spirit of the D3, we thought we'd talk about another camera with a 3 in its name.
Which is the F3.
A classic.
Right, it's been a little while since we've done a segment on one of the classic Nikon cameras, one of the manual focus ones. And so we thought, hey, let's do the F3. And it's a favorite of mine. We'll talk more about it later. And then we've got a few other topics. One relates to simplicity in shooting, which, as you might guess, relates a little bit to the F3, but it applies to other cameras too. And then what else do we have on the list, Jason?
Well, we're going to talk about changing up your in-camera settings while in the field. This is especially important for JPEG shooters, and but just in any kind of photography, identifying conditions where you want to optimize and tweak some of your in-camera settings, like white balance and contrast, and some of those parameters.
And to help make that topic clear, one of the things that we'll discuss too is, when does setting those parameters matter, and when doesn't it? You mentioned
right.
JPEGs, NX shooters. If you're shooting RAW with some of the other converters, then it doesn't matter. But we'll talk about that.
Correct. Yeah. And then, of course, we'll have our weekly prescription. Mm-hmm. And this week, we're going to talk a little bit about some tips for soft-proofing.
Right.
So stay tuned for those.
Yep.
But moving on to our venerable trip down memory lane that we've been neglecting for so long, we wanted to talk about the Nikon F3, mm-hmm. which came out in 1980, I think.
Yep.
And the F3 is a pretty unique camera because of its just how long it's lasted. It really has a longevity record, I think. And it's the last of the manual focus Nikon F bodies. Mm-hmm. And so it really has a pretty prominent place in Nikon history because of some of the features that it had. And you've brought one of your F3s today because mm-hmm. you said you had two of them.
I do.
This is the standard F3 with the standard prism.
Right, and the other common model of F3, we'll talk about variants later, is what's called the F3 HP for high eye point. And that was one that was introduced a few years after the camera first came out and turned out to be a popular feature. It's a little bit lower magnification viewfinder, which gives you a slightly smaller image. Now, that sounds bad. But if you're someone that wears eyeglasses, or if you're in a situation where you just can't get your eye quite as close to the viewfinder, it makes it easier to see the entire image.
Yeah.
I actually like the original viewfinder a little bit better. I don't wear eyeglasses, and I like the slightly larger image. And it turns out it's also a little bit lower profile, you know, a little bit lower height.
Now, interestingly enough, speaking about the lower mm-hmm. profile and the lower height, when you look at it compared to some of the earlier F cameras, the prism seems pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why that is because this was the first Nikon body that put the light meter electronics in the body
right.
and not in the prism.
Right.
Before this, you always had the light metering hardware was all in mm-hmm. that prism, and that increased the size of it.
Yeah, and now the good thing, you know, with those early bodies like the F and F2, you know, where it had the meter in the prism is, there were a lot of changes going on at the time with light metering, and it gave Nikon users an easy way of upgrading over time. So even though you maybe got your F with a non-metering prism, later on you could get one that had, you know, a nice center-weighted match needle kind of approach without, you know, having to get a whole new camera body. And the same thing was true with F2 users. You know, at the end they were able to get things with LED metering indications, a lot like what you would find in an FM or an FM2.
Now, the basic control layout on this camera is very similar to some of the other cameras we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the knob on the right-hand side for the frame advance and the shutter, and then a knob that controls the shutter speed settings. Mm-hmm. And then you could also put it in aperture priority.
Mm-hmm. And it was the first pro body that had automatic exposure.
So you could just put in that A
right.
setting and do that.
Lots of consternation at the time, as I recall.
And then over on the left-hand side, there's the film rewind knob.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, that's also underneath that is where the hot shoe is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to mount a flash on this camera, we'll talk about the flash in a little bit later in the segment, but you had to have a special kind of shoe, mm-hmm. not the traditional hot shoe that you're used to seeing on the top of the prism.
Yeah, the F-series cameras up to and including the F3 had an F3, but it's in fact different. It's incompatible. And the F3 is has its own unique flash system, which, like you said, we'll talk about later.
Now, other features that we see is there's the exposure compensation mm-hmm. dial. It's got a depth of field preview. Mm-hmm. It's got a manual mirror lockup.
Right. It's got an auto exposure lock, so that if you're in auto exposure mode, you can point the central part of the metering area at the subject that you want rendered, neutral gray or thereabouts. Press the button in and lock it. You don't have to use exposure compensation. Because honestly, on the F3, the way it works, it's a little bit of a pain in the neck. It's not quite as easy to use as on some other cameras. It's a little bit fiddly.
You got to push that little tiny button and twist it.
Yeah, it's
on.
Very stiff. And I mean, you can make it work, but I usually use the camera in either manual exposure or by using the auto exposure lock.
Now, another interesting feature on the F3, as long as we're talking about the mm-hmm. meter, is that the metering pattern, it's center weighted, but it's an 80-20.
Right. It's very tight. It's not quite a spot meter, but just like with all the older Nikons that had center weighted meters, you see a circle inside the viewfinder, which shows you where most of the metering is concentrated. And with the F3, almost all of it is inside that circle.
And staring at you here from, 3 feet away, your entire head is within that circle.
Right. Right now we've got a 35 millimeter 1.4 lens on
the
camera.
Which feels so nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful lens.
It looks like we have a sync terminal or some kind of, is that for a flash? Or mm-hmm. So there's
a PC
one of those with another, terminal. A PC terminal that you can lose the cover from, but you mm-hmm. managed not to do that.
No, that's because I bought a whole bag full of them several years ago.
And then other, accessories, as with most of the F cameras, you had interchangeable viewfinders, mm-hmm. interchangeable prisms, and you could get a motor winder for it, mm-hmm. which depending on the batteries, you could drive film advance up to 6 frames a second if you locked the mirror up.
Right. Now, I didn't bring the other F3 I have, which is the HP version, has the motor on it, and I didn't bring that. I don't really use that so much anymore. What I find is that, for one, it makes the camera a lot bulkier. It's pretty loud. I should have brought it just so we could have recorded the sound. I mean, it's a great classic sound, but it really does get bulky, and what I find is that that's not really using the F3 in its best role today. If you're shooting a lot of action photography, whether it's wildlife or sports or things like that, honestly, you're probably better off with one of the more modern autofocus cameras or digital body, especially. And so what I'm finding is that these days, I don't use that motor drive much at all, even though it was a very good one. Instead, I use the camera in its more stripped-down form, mm-hmm. Which makes it very compact, lightweight, nice to carry around. A lot of times if I'm going out hiking or something like that, the F3 is what I take. I throw it with something like the 35-1.4 or maybe a 55 macro lens, and then, one or two other, small primes, and it just makes a really nice outfit for hiking around.
Now, something interesting about the history of the F3 is, we talk about this camera. It was introduced in 1980, and it wasn't discontinued for like 21 years.
Right.
So this thing was being produced until 2001, if you do the math, mm-hmm. which is just incredible if you think about it.
Well, I'll tell you, the only issue with it is the funky flash system. Everything else was just done so well. It's just such a nice camera to use.
Now, when this camera came out, mm-hmm. you were telling me that a lot of pros were reluctant to switch to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this had something to do with the battery and the electronics. Is this correct?
Yeah. The F2, although it used batteries to run the meter, you didn't have to have batteries to run the shutter. And
so it was all mechanical.
Right. And people just were not quite used to that concept. You know, they, and like a lot of things, you know, with change in photography, you've always got a segment of photographers that just react against any kind of change. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, requiring batteries or auto exposure or autofocus or digital. You've always had a section of people that just don't like change. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it has a lot to do with photography, actually. I don't think they probably like change in other respects. Over time, people got over it and realized, you know, it's pretty easy to carry a couple little button cells in your bag. And if the battery goes out, then you use them.
And usually the batteries in these things last quite a while anyway.
Oh, yeah. They last a long time. And if you hook a motor drive up to it, you know, one little piece of trivia is it, when you do that, it turns out the motor drive powers the camera. So it's no longer the little button cells. It's the big double A's that are in the motor drive that are powering the shutter and the metering system. And yeah, that was a big thing for a couple of years until people got used to it. And then the camera just turned out to be outrageously popular.
Yeah, and quite honestly, reliable. If the battery were to die in this camera, you would still be able to use the shutter mechanically at a 60th of a second, mm-hmm. which isn't saying much, but it's still a backup.
Yeah.
You still take an image,
yeah.
you know, given that limitation.
Right.
So I thought that was just kind of interesting. Now, the flash system you said is kind of weird, but
yeah.
Now this camera offered TTL flash, right? Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, was that the first Nikon camera to offer that? Or?
I think so.
So that's a big deal.
It was.
The lens flash metering.
Right.
Now the problem was is that it only worked that way with certain flashes.
Right.
The ones that were really designed to be used with the F3.
Right. And for the most part, those were Nikon flashes. You know, they made several different ones of differing sizes. There was the bigger SB16, which had a tilt zoom flash head, you know, pretty nice flash. And then some smaller ones. I think the...
You get an SB17.
And 17, maybe.
An SB17. They made a special version of the SB15 and an SB16A. Mm-hmm. And then apparently there was a ring flash SR2 that you could use with this.
Yeah.
Any other flash unit, you could get an adapter to mount it in the shoe, but it wouldn't work in TTL mode.
Yeah. I think there was maybe one Vivitar flash that had an F3 shoe, but it wasn't very common. And by the way, if you ever run onto a little Vivitar flash adapter for the F3, realize that while it'll allow you to put another flash in the shoe of an F3, it does not work with TTL, despite what you'll read some places. It just does not. It's missing some of the electrical components to do that. And what I found, because I tried one time, it also has a very loose connection. So I wouldn't recommend that thing.
So TTL flash... That's pretty important because now the flash is able to meter through the lens mm-hmm. instead of just using that little electronic eye sensor on the flash to look for return
right.
light and, you know, or just putting in manual mode. So that can offer up some improved photographic creative mm-hmm. possibilities by having that.
It was really nice for close-up work if you had a macro lens that you were using, or it could be a macro lens on a bellows. Because there's a lot of light loss when you do that. And traditional flash, you know, non-TTL flash was really kind of a pain in the neck. You know, the combination of having to figure out how much light was lost and adjusting the aperture based on that. And, you know, there were no histograms to look at to double check.
Blowing out your subject.
Yeah. So having the TTL thing was a big positive.
Now, on the negative side, there's one kind of... probably the only major negative on this camera is the flash sync speed because
mm-hmm.
it was only an 80th of a second.
Right.
And that's compared to almost all the other cameras out there. I mean, heck, my EL2 mm-hmm. syncs up at 1/25th of a second mm-hmm. or 1/125th of a second. And so that's pretty substantial. But then it didn't have TTL flash either. So,
right. You know, what a lot of photographers ended up doing was, you know, carrying around a backup camera that was something like an FM2 or an FE2, something like that, that had a 250th flash sync. And the FE2 especially, you know, had a TTL flash. So it made for a nice backup camera for those times where you wanted to do some things with flash.
So that's kind of the downside. Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a few variants of the F3 that we probably ought to talk briefly about.
And right. You already mentioned the HP.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ones that you'll commonly find, you know, the regular and the HP. Now, one you know, little caveat on getting the regular one is that usually when you see those for sale, it's camera with its original prism, which means it was an early version. Because after that, they discontinued that version. And so the HP ones will be usually a little bit newer, potentially might have fewer miles on them, although you never really know. The one I have here, I actually had the F3 HP first, and then I got this one, I can't remember, maybe 6 years or so ago. It was just dirt cheap. I think I paid less than $300 for it, and it's in really nice shape. Never had any problems with it, but, you know, it's an earlier F3. But, you know, some of the other ones that you'll see, if you look on eBay or places like that, you'll see titanium versions of the F3 and two that are more common. There's one that's in a lighter colored, kind of a silverish,
the champagne.
Goldish champagne, I think it's called sometimes, finish. And then one that's black that's got kind of a pebble texture to it. The champagne one, if you find one that's in really nice shape, it's ridiculously expensive. And one of the reasons why, it's kind of a neat-looking camera, but the titanium finish on these things really doesn't wear well. If the camera's been used at all, you end up with lots of ugly marks, you know, around the thing, around where the shoulder strap attaches on the prism. So it's really uncommon to find one that just doesn't look all beaten up. With the ones that are black finished, they tend to wear a little bit better. But both are in the collector's item category if they're nice looking. So the prices tend to get pretty high. And you're not getting a whole lot extra in terms of benefits with them, honestly. And then there are a few other, you know, uncommon ones. High-speed version.
An F3H?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a... F3AF, which used a very early form of autofocus. It just worked with a couple lenses, I think an 80 and a 200. And you could use other lenses with it. And you had a focus indication system that's pretty similar to what you find with current autofocus Nikons, where a little dot would light up when it was in focus. But the prism was very bulky. And... kind of a marginal benefit, frankly. And there were a couple called the Limited and the F3P, which were oriented to press photographers, slightly stripped down in terms of features.
Better weather sealing in some cases.
Yeah. But those tend to be collector's items, too, if they're in decent shape.
Yeah, because apparently the F3P, when it was announced, was you could only buy it if you were an NPS member.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they released it to the general public, but by that time. Mm-hmm. But what's really nice about the F3 is if you're looking for a good manual focus camera, very few can beat this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really got it all. And one of the nice things about an F3 is that, you know, because it doesn't use the autofocus lenses, it means you have to go and explore some manual focus mm-hmm. lenses to use with it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these older manual focus lenses are just so nice to operate.
Yeah, they really are. In many cases, they're very sharp lenses. They're well made.
And they're ridiculously compact.
Yeah, they really are. I brought a couple lenses along with the camera in today. You know, I already mentioned it. The one that we're looking at the moment has a 35-1.4 on it.
And it's not much bigger than a regular 50mm
no,
lens.
Just
a little bit bigger.
A little bit bulkier, more like the 51.2 in some respects. But it's not bad, and it's great in low light and really nice general purpose lens, too. It's very sharp, you know, when stopped down. And I brought, you know, one of the classic portrait lenses of all time, which is the 105 2.5.
And we talked about that lens a little mm-hmm. bit a couple episodes ago.
Yeah, and the one I brought is the AIS version. And, you know, really nice and compact, super sharp, nice image quality.
And to put it in perspective, mm-hmm. what you're holding in your hand now is literally one-third the size of the 105 VR that we, I mean, it's just unbelievably small. If you were to show me that lens in your hand, I never would guess that it was 105 millimeter focal length.
And over time, I think we've just all gotten used to bigger and bigger cameras and lenses. These didn't seem that small at the time. You know, I remember using them, you know, way back, and they just seemed normal, but things have gotten quite large. So it's kind of refreshing to have something that's small. And then I've also got the 200 F4 AIS lens, and, you know, it's a teensy little thing too. You know, very compact, light, and quite sharp.
Which, if I were looking at that, I would have guessed that that would have been a 100-and-something millimeter lens, like a 135 or something.
Yeah.
And instead, it's a 200 f4.
Yeah.
And it's got, I think it's, what, a 52-millimeter filter thread?
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine how small these things are, but they work just fantastically
wonderful. Yeah, in fact, all the lenses that we just talked about that I brought today have 52-millimeter threads.
So that's
the
cool.
old standard.
Yeah, and that's great if you have one set of filters. Mm-hmm. A set of some nice lenses and a camera that has a simplistic, you know, straightforward set of controls and metering system.
Right. And I didn't have time to grab it, but, you know, a favorite wide angle to use in conjunction with these lenses for me was always the 24 millimeter 2.8, which was very sharp. I really like the focal length that complements the 35 really well. And it's just ultra teensy in size. So, you know, when you take a bag, you know, with these lenses along, and oftentimes I might leave the 200 at home, just small, lightweight, nice to handle, good in available light. I like shooting out of my Domke F6, which I brought today. It's just this really simple canvas bag. I think it's the photo equipment equivalent of a pair of nice, worn Levi's jeans, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's just very simple, very comfortable.
Well, and yours happens to be blue.
Mine happens to be blue.
Yeah. So it kind of looks like it's...
So when you take a bag like this out, it's great. Which gets us to the next topic.
Right.
Of simplicity.
Which is simplicity in shooting. And we were talking the other day before this podcast, but, you know, we were trying to brainstorm for topics. And, you know, everyone is so caught up with, you know, do I need to get the latest gear? Do I need to, you know, all these features? And you're talking about whether the 51-point autofocus system is better than the, you know, 11-point autofocus system, et cetera, and, you know, 3D matrix metering too. And, you know, we're thinking about it. And, you know, at the end of the day, as photographers, you know, there's two things that appeal to me, and I think to you too, but one of them is the technical side. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes spend a lot of time on the technical side. But
we know it's a popular topic.
It is. And, you know, it's always cool to see the latest and greatest features and the bells and the whistles. But at the end of the day, it's about the pictures that you're trying to take. It's about the photograph, and it's the creative side.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing you want to do is get poor images because you don't know enough. Because you spend too much time worrying about the technical side of your gear.
Right.
You know, you want to the thing I like to think about is the camera. If you're a good photographer, the camera at some point should become transparent to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that tool that you're using, and you can concentrate on composition. And that means that you get better photographs because you're not fighting with your equipment. You know enough of the rules. So there's a couple of things that you can do to simplify things.
Mm-hmm. One of them, I think, is recognize what are good tools for the kind of photography that you're doing. And, you know, we talked a little bit about situations where I'll take my F3 out. And, you know, if I'm going hiking or something like that, or just on a family trip to somewhere, I don't need a 200 to 400 zoom. I don't need 5 frames per second, certainly. Very frankly, I don't even necessarily need autofocus or lots of other things. And sometimes that stuff can really even get in the way. You know, if your equipment is so heavy to carry around and it takes so long to set up and get in place, that's a good way to lose pictures just right there. You know, so you can have a false sense of security and a false sense of getting benefits from these features, which actually can end up biting you just because of setup time, and, you know, especially if you're not comfortable with the camera.
Right. And, you know, here's the thing about manual focus cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about autofocus and how many AF points and all the goodies.
Right.
And Well, you know, with a manual focus camera, you pretty much had infinite focus points because you use your eyeball and you just looked on the, you know, and you'd use the split prism, you know, viewfinder, but
you didn't
but you didn't have to. And for the most part, you could just sort of tell when the part that you wanted was in focus, you took the picture. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to worry about recomposing and all that other stuff that we talk about doing so much. Yeah. The other thing is also the meters were more simple. Now, you had to know how to use them.
Right.
You have to understand that. And I think that's no matter what camera that you use, one way to simplify your life is to understand your equipment. You know, just going out and getting the D3 with all its bells and whistles is not going to make you a better photographer.
No.
Because every
camera... It could even make you a worse photographer.
Right. I mean, the autofocus system, again, in the D2 challenged a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to figure out what exactly it was doing so that you could learn to use it. Because the camera, again, you shouldn't have to really be consciously thinking about when you're on a shoot, when you're doing something. Like I was shooting at a soccer game last weekend, and you pretty much want to be able to say for a particular condition, this is what I need to set up my camera like. And if I have if I'm not getting the results that I want in the field, I immediately know how to change that to remedy the solution. Same thing about exposure. You know, if you don't know how your meter behaves in certain situations, you're going to end up with images that don't look so good.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, there's something about the simplicity of just using aperture priority or even manual with a center weighted meter. If you knew what you were doing, it sort of took stuff out of the equation. You didn't have to worry about strain, you know, as long as you knew how to identify the situation. So for the gear that you have, know it, learn it, and know how to apply it when you're in the field so that you can spend less time worrying about the equipment and more time worrying about what's actually in the viewfinder, the subject.
Now, you know, one comment that I've made before in podcasts, I think it's been a while, but I know I've made it at least a couple times. I'm not really convinced that everyone that's shooting digital should be shooting digital. Now, it's always their choice and their preference and their, you know, the nice things about immediacy and stuff, but I really do believe in my heart that there's a set of photographers out there that probably would be better off shooting color print film in many cases.
Right.
You know, there are challenges with digital, including a narrower latitude range. Not quite as narrow as slide film was, but it's definitely more narrow than print film.
I mean, you could practically screw up by two stops on print film and take it down to the drugstore and you'd get decent prints out of it.
Right. And if you're truly not interested in working, you know, with your images on the computer, which I kind of like doing because it reminds me of the darkroom work. But if you're really not interested in that and you really don't want to worry about a lot of stuff and mess around with a lot of stuff, putting a roll of print film in one of the older camera bodies is a wonderful way to shoot. And I still like doing it at times where I just frankly don't want to worry a whole lot about precise exposure and things like that.
Well, and it solves other problems too. It solves your post-processing, like you mentioned, because you take it to the lab and they do it for you. And with print film, you've got enough latitude to usually cover up some mistakes that you might otherwise would see with digital. And also it solves the storage problem because you can just take your prints and you have your negatives and you can...
There they are.
And you put them in a photo album and everybody can see it. Yes. Yeah, it's harder to email them, but you could always scan the print. You know, we certainly did that a lot. I did that tons before I had digital cameras. It just depends on what you're trying to do. But that going to film can really simplify things because the film cameras, you know, at the end of the day, they do what they're designed to do. You put film in them and they take pictures with them and you don't have to worry about all these complicated parameters and settings. As long as you get your exposure right and you take pictures that are in focus, it's going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very good.
Just an option to think about.
Now, another thing also to consider is, you know, to simplify your life is think about what you're bringing before you load up that camera bag with your 200 to 400 and your, you know, and every possible lens and God knows
every possible
guilty
filter.
Of doing this. And,
oh yeah.
You know, one of the things that you can simplify yourself like with filters is when you're going out to look for lenses, I know it's not always 100% possible, but when you can get filter threads or lenses that share the same diameter filter thread, then you have one polarizer in your bag and you can just change it between cameras. You don't need 17 different adapter rings and all other kinds of stuff like that. Don't overpack. You know, these manual focus lenses are so small, you could throw three of them in a body into a bag and still have space left over for other kinds of stuff.
You know, and one thing I think is really important is, especially if you're in a situation where you're going to need to stay mobile, don't take so much stuff that you end up not wanting to walk around and get shots because your equipment is so heavy or bulky. And that's not something that's always easy to forecast when you're at home and you've just packed up a bag, you lift it up. Well, it doesn't seem too bad. But after 4 hours on your back or your shoulder, it's going to feel twice as heavy as it did at your house. So I think there's something to be said for deliberately going a little bit light in many situations, or at least giving yourself the option of shedding some equipment at times, you know, that may not be quite as essential. Sometimes less is more in this situation. Mm-hmm. And if taking less makes you more mobile, more energized, more willing to get out there and photograph for a longer period of time, then that's probably the way you ought to go.
You know, get a monopod instead of a tripod, unless you're, you know, on that kind of a trip. I know
you can do fantastic shots with a single prime lens if it's the right one for how you see, you know, and only you will know that. But
and then the last thing that I have on my little short list of simplifying things is just go back and learn your rules. If you don't know the basics of exposure and you don't understand the rules of composition, then you're going to have to think about them every time, and it makes it less fun to shoot. As you get more and more used to knowing how to recognize situations in the field to make that quick tweak of exposure compensation, and when you learn to recognize scenes to give you ideal compositions or things that are pleasing, you'll stop taking snapshots and you'll start taking photographs. Mm-hmm. And that's when it really gets fun. Because you're not, you know, that camera can just sort of become an extension as a creative tool as it's intended to be. All the new features, all the bells and whistles are really intended to allow us to take things that might have been tricky before and make them easier for us when you're shooting in the field. All the autofocus stuff, all the new meters, all the fancy stuff. But if you don't know how to use them, they can just be in the way.
Right.
So if you're going to, you know, so learn your equipment and learn your rules.
The way I look at it is all of us, you know, have only so much brain capacity
at 4:30 in the morning.
At 4:30 in the morning, especially.
Oxbow Bend, yeah.
And now some people are better at it than others, but we're all still limited. And honestly, it's very hard to do your best on the creative aspects, the compositional aspects, other things like that, if your head is full of, well, exactly what shutter speed or aperture or metering pattern or, you know, which filter or whatever should I use? If you can get that down to a known set in advance, you know before you even set up the shot what you're going to be doing, then chances are your photographs are going to be a little bit better because all of your brain power will be on the composition. Or the lighting or the idea.
Right. And it's kind of like when I've had some conversations with novice photographers, you know, when we talked about this when we did our exposure episode. But, you know, they want to know what shutter speed or what aperture do I use? Which one do you use? And we always say, well, it really depends.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can give you some suggested, but it really just depends. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want depth of field, if you just know, hey, this is a landscape shot and I want everything in focus, I know I want F11, that's remove one thing from that equation that you don't have to worry about. Mm-hmm. You're not sitting there thinking.
Your brain's not cycling on that.
Right. Or if you notice that, gee, I'm not stopping the action here, I guess my shutter speed is too low, I better open up my aperture or choose a higher ISO to do that rather than what is the shutter speed that I want. You know, if you have an idea going into the shot, into the shooting situation, then you know more or less what you need, then you have a far smaller subset of things that you need to change to get the kind of results that you want.
Yeah. So kind of wrapping up some of the thoughts in this area, we talked about several different things. One is, you know, choosing the right equipment and choosing something that isn't more complex than it needs to be for your preferences, your shooting situations. Another one is taking the time in non-critical situations to learn your equipment, learn the modes, get your camera set up the way that you'll likely want it in advance of doing your photographs. What else?
Knowing what to bring,
and, not too much,
and learning your rules for exposure, composition, et cetera, to make them second nature to you.
Yeah.
So those are all, and that kind of, you know, our idea of knowing the rules and knowing your equipment flows right into the next topic we want to talk about, which is now a digital topic, but it's setting up some in-camera settings when you're out in the field, identifying situations where you might need to tweak something and why, and this is usually in the Nikon cameras. There's the camera settings screen menu where you can choose what ISO and the contrast and the color mode and all those the parameters. You know, whether it's shooting RAW or JPEG or some combination of both. Sometimes you'll have banks of these where you could set presets. Other times you won't. Depends on the camera. But the three big ones that you know, you'll see sharpening, contrast setting, white balance setting, color mode setting. Those are really the biggest ones because everything else, I mean, when you go into a shoot, chances are you're not going to be switching back and forth between JPEG and RAW. You may change the ISO based on conditions. You're probably not going to change the JPEG compression settings,
right?
You know, in the middle of a shoot. Those are going to be things you pretty much set up. But there are some things that will change with different conditions going back and forth. The three biggest ones that you might find yourself changing would be the contrast and white balance, and in some cases, the color mode. I'd say you're probably less likely to change the color mode in the middle of a shoot. But, you know, if you're changing subjects, that could happen. So the first one, and usually the one that makes a huge difference in the images that you take, is something like white balance.
Right.
And that, because that's going to affect the color cast, and the quality of the color of your image. And depending on a lot of us just say, oh, I'll just put it on automatic. And then we'll get shots that we come back and they're just not quite the way we want it. Maybe they're a little bit too cool or a little bit too orange. You know, what's going on here?
And some things can really surprise you. You know, for example, I just tend to leave mine on the automatic setting for the most part because I'm shooting RAW and it's very easy to override that later. But it's funny, you know, some of the early morning shots that I was making up in the Tetons, and, you know, you've got sun coming up and all this kind of stuff, nice warm light on the mountains. What you end up getting with your auto white balance is a very warm setting because it's seeing all the cool shadows and things like that. And in my case,
brown skies.
Yeah, you get brown, almost non-existent skies because it's taking out the blue. And so a lot of times the best thing to do is put your white balance on something like daylight.
Yeah.
Maybe cloudy at the worst, but, you know, something that's
I've
not
had very
super
good
warm.
Luck with setting it to sunny as my default for landscapes. And I figure that gets me close enough. If you're seeing brown skies in your images, consider changing your white balance to a daylight setting.
Right. And if you shot RAW, which is what we like to do, just, you know, make that adjustment.
Make the adjustment.
You'll be surprised. Bang, there's your sky. Now you can see your clouds again. It's amazing what it'll do.
Yeah, and white balance is something that's, you know, absolutely critical for you JPEG shooters out there, because if it's way off, you're going to have a really hard time getting a normal, natural looking image, you know, correcting that. So, you know, setting using a white balance setting or having a gray card with, you know, a white balance gray card, like the Weibel card we've talked about, you know, is a great idea, you know, to get it right. But, the warmer settings work really well, like the cloudy or I never use shade, but, you know, the cloudy settings, those work best when you don't have sky in your image, where you're shooting, you know, a subject that doesn't include the sky, like on an overcast day. Then it works just fine.
Right.
And what I've also found with white, even for RAW shooters, if you shoot and the white balance is really off, even with RAW, you can have a challenge recovering it. So you want to get it at least close. And that's why the daylight setting is such a nice kind of default. It puts you right in the ballpark for almost all natural light situations. You can always warm it up or cool it down a little bit. But if you're outdoors, the daylight setting is a great place to be because it gives you a lot of latitude to fix things later. Mm-hmm. If you're inside, that's different. You know, you have artificial lighting. You'll want to pick the right white balance setting there. But if you shoot tungsten white balance outdoors and you have some highlights that tend to clip a little bit, you're going to see some challenges, even with RAW, bringing back the proper colors into those highlight areas. Now, the next one on our list is contrast settings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal, too. Because I think by default, most of the cameras are set up to use either an auto contrast setting, which I've never used, or a normal contrast setting. And this, again, makes a big difference if you're shooting JPEG or RAW. Because, again, in RAW, you can kind of change it.
Yeah, and in fact, doesn't matter. You know, just to clarify things, it's only if you're using one of the Nikon converters that contrast parameter will even matter.
Right.
All the others will do whatever is in your defaults or your preset or things like that. And the in-camera settings are really just preset files too. I mean, mm-hmm. just a matter of, are they set in the camera or on the computer?
Right. So, but it makes a huge difference when you're shooting JPEGs
mm-hmm.
because it's always easier to add contrast and punch up an image than it is to remove contrast. Because right. at some point when you clip a shadow, when you block up those blacks, they're gone and there's no more detail in there.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised how much shadow detail comes out of an image when you change in Capture NX, for example, when you go from the normal setting to the low contrast setting. But there are some situations where, you know, what do I want to do? Well, if you're in bright sun, so all you guys taking pictures at soccer games and, you know, your kids are playing Little League or something and it's a bright sunny day, especially if you're shooting JPEG, try setting a low contrast setting if you can in your camera. Because that will really help bring out the shadow detail, especially for people. You don't want dark shadows under eyes or under right. their baseball cap or whatever. You know, that's really hard.
And again, it's not hard to add contrast. Later, you can throw in a curves adjustment or just
levels.
Or a contrast slider or whatever. It's easy to add it back in. You really can't take it out.
Right. Now,
JPEG.
Out of a JPEG, right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're shooting in overcast conditions, well, then normal contrast is going to work great, even for people in action mm-hmm. shots. You know, most of my landscape shots, my default setting is to use the normal contrast because I want a little bit more punchy blacks.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have found is in the really early morning shots where you've got a lot of dynamic range, where you can pretty much capture all of the dynamic range because the sun is not out yet,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes I'll get more out of my images by switching to the lower contrast tone curve in NX after the fact,
mm-hmm.
bringing up some shadow detail
mm-hmm.
in places where you really want to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always just adjust the levels later.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the normal contrast, you know, if you're in a, depending on what look you want, and that's the thing, if you're shooting in RAW, if you're not using Nikon converter, you can play around with curves to get the effect that you want for the kind of image that you want and make the presets.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're shooting in a JPEG, you really need to identify that light. You say, I'm in a really harsh lit condition and I'm taking pictures of people or animals where I want to see detail in the shadows and I don't want to see, you know, dark eye sockets.
Mm-hmm.
You got to think, I might want to switch to a low contrast setting.
Right.
And get that. Then the last one is color mode. Well, the last of the big three, I should say, is color mode.
Mm-hmm.
And this really applies to JPEG shooters or Nikon shooter or RAW shooters who use Capture or Capture NX. Because if you shoot RAW and you don't use a Nikon product to convert it like NX or Capture 4, color mode is absolutely irrelevant. You will get images that by default look kind of like mode 2 color.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the color modes in the past. Just a refresher, there's modes 1, 2, and 3. And depending on your camera, it also has to deal with color space, but that's different.
Yeah. And you'll also find the variance, you know, with a little
1A.
But
the bottom line is that if you're shooting pictures of people, whether it's portraits, sports, whatever, color mode 1 looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well for that because it doesn't overdo the skin tones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some of you guys out there who might have D50s, D40s, what Nikon did a while back was for some of those cameras, they set the default mode for in your normal settings to mode 3. That's the default color mode that comes in your camera just for the you know, when you get it off the shelf, mm-hmm. when it's in the store and you're testing it out. And Mode 3 Color was chosen for that because it's the punchiest. It's got the most saturation, especially in reds and greens. Mm-hmm. A little bit higher contrast than Mode 1.
Right.
So if you're sitting there in the store and you just take a picture and you look at the LCD screen, psychologically, Mode 3 Color will look better than Mode 1 Color if you were just trying to choose between two cameras.
Yeah, and in fact, you know,
it's a sales thing.
When the D50 came out, there were a number of people that were posting notes saying, hey, it's got better image quality than the D70. And if you didn't change the defaults in your D70, you were using Mode 1, which was a lower contrast thing for people.
Things look a little duller.
Right.
But skin tones look really good.
Right. It was the right setting for that kind of work. You know, Mode 3 was nicer in a lot of respects for landscapes and stuff like that, but, you know, very different look.
Right.
Now, both cameras could be set the other way. It was just, right. you know, how they chose to.
And if you have a D50 and you go into the menus and you choose the portrait setting, you'll notice that it changes the color mode to Mode 1. Mm-hmm. And there's also ways to manually do it if you have a custom setting. But in general, be careful shooting people in Mode 3. It's not that you can't, but you might start getting, especially with some of the warmer white balance settings, you start Ugh. Getting pumpkin skin tones, and that's the last thing you want. Yeah. Everyone looks really ruddy and not so good.
Whereas Mode 1 does just a super job on flesh tones.
It really does.
I gotta say, you know, having used, you know, pretty much all the raw converters out there, that's one really nice thing about using NX or Capture, you know, the original Capture, is being able to access the Mode 1 stuff. It's just a little bit different than what you'll see coming out of the others. And flesh tones, you know, the Caucasian skin flesh tones, especially, just turn out a little bit nicer.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other setting you might want to think about would be your sharpening settings. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't something that you really would change on the fly in the field. But if you shoot raw, the sharpening settings obviously can be removed. Or if you use a third-party raw converter like ACR or Lightroom, whatever you want to use, the sharpening settings are completely irrelevant and they're ignored. Mm-hmm. Where it matters the most, though, is for JPEGs and for your LCD previews. Mm-hmm. As a raw shooter, even though I know I'm going to do my own fine-tuned sharpening settings later on in Capture NX, I will set my sharpening settings to the highest in the camera. And the only reason why I do that is because I want the image on the LCD to be as sharp as possible to let me know when I've reached critical focus in my previews.
Double checking to see if an eye is really in focus
Correct.
Or not. And I do the same thing.
Now,
doesn't mean I ever use that high sharpening setting
right.
for anything, because I don't, frankly.
And that's because the image that's on the LCD when you shoot a RAW file is really a JPEG that's embedded in that RAW file. Now, if you're shooting JPEG, I would not set sharpening to anything higher than the normal setting, which most people will say looks too soft.
Right.
In fact, you could set sharpening to low if you're really planning on setting, if you're in a situation, let's say you're shooting a landscape or you're shooting something that you know you're going to possibly want to make a large print from, like a 13x19, 12x18 size, you know, super A3 print, you might consider turning the sharpening, setting it to none.
Right.
Setting it off entirely and then leaving that for your post-processing.
This is one of the hard things about shooting JPEGs, really, because, you know, superficially it seems like it would make things easier.
Right.
The problem is that it locks you in to so many things at the time you make the shot and forces you to think through all of that stuff very actively when you're out in the field, that it really can be a little bit nicer just to shoot raw, make those decisions when you have lots of time. You can use all the cycles in your brain for that. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's a lot easier. I
right.
think it's a mistake to believe that raw is more complex for beginners. I think it's actually simpler, but
right. And, you know, and
it's
now
just a philosophy.
Along that line, I mean, one of the things that I really, really like about using the Nikon RAW converters is that all of those in-camera settings are there. The mode, the color modes, the tone curves, the sharpening. You can see in seconds when you're back at your computer what those different image parameters, what effects they have on your image. And that will allow you to go back and forth. Do I like mode one? Do I like mode three? You know, for, and that'll help you set up your camera to the style that you want for particular conditions, when you can recognize, hey, I was shooting on an overcast day and I realized I had to switch the white balance to cloudy, you know, later on to get it to look right. Or I realized that mode one color really looked better here and a normal contrast. That'll allow you to make those presets when you want to, if you've got like a D200 where you've got the banks and you can change, you know, you can choose four different shooting settings. Having that is something that, that you can do. Otherwise, you know, I mean, the other RAW converters are just as good. You just have to make your own presets for them. And then the in-camera settings are become almost meaningless other than your white balance.
Now, see, for me, I don't care about that so much. And the reason is it's just as easy for me to switch between a higher contrast setting in something that like Lightroom to a lower contrast one as it is in NX to go from a normal contrast curve to a low. It's the same thing.
But here's
just changing a setting.
But where it can make a difference is A, if you're shooting the JPEGs.
But I don't.
Which I know you don't.
Right.
Or B, if you're doing like what I was doing, which is sometimes I'll extract the JPEGs from the NEFs.
Right.
And then if that's the good enough image.
Right.
Without any major post-processing.
Right. And I just do that a different way.
Right.
I have presets that I apply when I download them.
Different workflow.
Yeah.
It's totally cool.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting if you want to learn more about how those modes and how those settings affect your image, then taking a look at the you know, download the free trial of Capture NX or, you know, get an old copy of Capture 4, it'll at least show you what those are doing in the camera. That's kind of interesting.
All right.
So we've made it to that, and we have just a few minutes left for our
prescription. Now, this is one related to soft proofing, and this was one of those things where you just slap your head when you see it done.
Yeah.
And I'll put in a quick plug for a really nice set of downloadable tutorials from the Luminous Landscape website, which is a very nice website if you've never looked at it, and it just luminous-landscape.com. All sorts of great stuff on there. And I know you look at it at times too and have learned things on there. But there's a set of tutorials that are in a QuickTime format. It's called From Camera to Print. And it's all about the printing process and talks about multiple tools, techniques, sharpening. I mean, you name it.
So these really, are videos.
Yeah,
videos. QuickTime movies.
Yeah, really good stuff. It's more than 6 hours of tutorials. It goes for $34.95. It's absolutely worth it if you care about your images. So I guess one part of this tip is, get it. You know, if you're using Photoshop or Lightroom or things like that for printing, great information. But the specific tip in there, and we won't go into excruciating detail on this because I think it's only fair to say, you know, get the video download, but has to do with bringing up a duplicate image within either Photoshop, where you could also do this in NX. We tried it this morning. And so you've got your original, and then you've got one where you'll turn on soft proofing, and you can see the two images side by side.
Right, you can tile the two windows on the screen. You duplicate the image.
Right, and what that allows you to do is now do a series of adjustments to that soft proofed image to make it look like the original. And what that usually involves is you know, pumping up the blacks a little bit, lifting up some of the mids slightly, doing a little bit of a curves adjustment, and then also increasing the saturation level of your soft proofed image just slightly.
Yeah,
you know,
somewhere
with Photoshop,
like 5 to 10 points at most.
At most. I usually do something around 4 or 5, and makes it really easy to get that soft proof thing looking just like the original, and then that's what you print from, is the soft proof version. Great little tip that was in there. There's a lot more information in there.
Because it's all about having a target.
Yeah. And what I always did in the
past. I can't believe I never did that.
No, I
toggle just a soft proof on and off.
It just, again, I want to smack myself for not thinking about it. It's such a simple thing. I always soft proofed it and then adjusted it to when I thought it looked good. And this is a lot easier. A lot easier. So great tip that I learned from that.
Absolutely. Okay, well, this brings us, you've managed to stay awake, hopefully, through our show this week. And as usual, we're always looking for suggestions for topics. We do have some topics. We've been getting some emails that we do plan on using. We just didn't get to them this week because they're a little larger than what we had. But we've been getting some good suggestions. But please keep them coming and contact us at, send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we will be sure to answer your email. Also, don't forget the podcast forum, the feedback forum in the Nikonians forums. It's down there a little bit, but it's there, and we do go through there, and we try to answer posts in that too.
Yeah, and as always, we appreciate the many positive comments that we've gotten on Podcast Alley.
Absolutely.
And you can look for us there under the Talk Radio, Nikonians Talk Radio item as well.
Okay, so that's all for this week. We'll see you again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.